Hey, this is Joe Mama. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. On today's broadcast, host Teresa Wilkie talks with Paul Pierce and Greta Wills of the KCMO Human Relations Department about housing discrimination against those with convictions and the laws that protect them. Then, in the second half, host Melvin Merritt speaks with Joshua Aiken of the Justice Policy Institute about deaths in custody reporting program of the Justice Department. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and as always, the 420 Drug War News at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Teresa and her guests.
Good morning. We're lucky today to have Paul Pierce and Greta Wills from the Kansas City Human Relations Department. We're going to talk about employment, housing, and public accommodation discrimination. Kansas City, Missouri had its first Human Relations Commission in the 1940s by City Commission ordinance. Racial tension in our city was high in 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King, and then the City Commission codified and created the Human Relations Commission. In 1981, remedial powers were given, and a 7-member Human Relations Board was created. Okay, Paul, it looks like you currently have a staff of 7, and the head is Philip Yelder, who has been director since 2005?
That's right. We have an intake officer, 6 investigators, 3 for housing, 3 for employment mainly. And as you said, Philip Yelder has been our director for a little over 10 years now, I guess 12 years now.
And explain the agency. Where are you located?
Well, our office is located on the 4th floor of City Hall at 414 East 12th Street. It's the building across from the Jackson County Courthouse on the south, the police station headquarters and municipal court on the east, and the park in front of the federal courthouse to the north.
And just exactly what is it that you do?
Well, mainly I investigate employment discrimination complaints. When I started with the department in 98, I started off as a housing investigator. We had a backlog of employment cases at that time, and after about 2 years on the job, I switched over and started investigating employment cases, and I've been doing that ever since.
So do you address any size employer?
Well, for an employer to be within the city's jurisdiction, there has to be at least 6 employees. The alleged discriminatory act has to have taken place within the city limits of Kansas City, and it cannot include a political subdivision or another level of government. The city doesn't have the authority by statute to investigate the county or the state or even the federal government, but as long as the employer is not another, you know, government entity, and there's at least 6 employees, and there's a way to calculate, you know, who's an employee, part-time, full-time, seasonal, what have you. So there are some initial questions to answer in terms of what employers that we can investigate, but it's 3 or 4 elements that we have to cover before we can say, yes, we have the authority to investigate this employer.
And what's your jurisdiction?
Our jurisdiction is the city limits of Kansas City. As long as an allegation arises within our geographic limits, the city of Kansas City has the authority to investigate. It can't be, for example, in Raymore, because that, of course, is outside Kansas City, Missouri. But any incident that occurs within the city limits of Kansas City falls within our jurisdiction.
And these incidents are allegations of discrimination against the person with the complaint because of race, sex, color, national origin,
disability, religion, age, and under the city ordinance, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Those two last categories are not protected by state law or federal law, but our ordinance was amended to include both. I think the gender identity ordinance passed while I was working there, I think in 2010 maybe, either 2008 or 2010. Those categories, except for sexual orientation and gender identity, are protected under state law and federal law.
The other categories.
That's right.
And the federal law is currently picking up sex orientation and gender identity under stereotyping sex, Title VII sex.
Right.
So very generically. But that's bravo to the city of Kansas City, Missouri, that they're specific in the protection of people for their gender status and sex orientation.
Right.
So what is the timeliness of a complaint? Of course, the sooner the better. Is that true?
For our department to investigate a complaint, the alleged discriminatory act has to have taken place you have to file within 180 days of the last alleged discriminatory act. So for example, if someone felt like they were discriminated against based on disability, and the incident that led to the filing, they believe, took place February 1st, that person would have until basically 6 months, or October 1st, is that 6 months? August 1st, I'm sorry. To file that complaint to be under our ordinance. Now, that's different under EEOC regulations, which is 300 days or more like 10 months. But our ordinance, the alleged incident has to occur within 180 days of filing.
And so then you take a complaint. Is that what you call them, complaints?
Yes, yes.
And you investigate it. How is that done?
Well, what we do is our intake officer, we have an intake form, and from that form, be it a paper form or online through our website, kcmo.org, our intake officer will generate a complaint form. It's signed by the person wanting to file the complaint, sent back to us for service on the employer. Once that happens, the employer would have 10 business days to either respond to the complaint or request some type of extension, which is common, happens all the time. But we'll receive the response statement, contact the person who's filed the complaint, and get a statement from them, the details which led to them filing the complaint. They are allowed to read over the response statement. They don't get a copy of it at the time because the case is still open. So they can read over and make comments or ask questions about what's included in the position statement. They can supply names and phone numbers of witnesses who they believe can verify the allegations of their complaint. And then we'll meet with the employer, employees, managers, supervisors are either listed in a response statement or come up during the course of an interview, and do the same thing with the witnesses, the employer's witnesses. The complainant's witnesses, if they have any, will gather necessary documents that will help us make a recommendation on the evidence. And when all that is done, there's a report that's written, a recommendation that's made on the evidence as to whether or not there is or is not probable cause to verify the allegations in the complaint.
So you do, Kansas City Human Relations Department does employment, public accommodation, and housing.
That's right.
Of those three, what do you receive more often?
Well, I believe we have more employment complaints right now in the office. I think second would be housing, and then third, public accommodations. Not because of importance, certainly, but that's just how things come in. We just seem to get more employment complaints in. And each one goes through pretty much the same process in terms of investigation.
Thank you for that. I would agree that jobs are important and housing is important, but the idea that a person could be refused service, mm-hmm. or treated less favorably because of their race, sex, color, in a place of public accommodation
right.
is a large part of your city ordinance. And so if a person felt discriminated against in their access to places of business right. and services, mm-hmm. They can file a complaint with the city of Kansas City, Missouri, if it happened in Kansas City, Missouri, correct?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So now then, pertaining to those with criminal convictions, I understand the ban the box ordinance is an old ordinance in Kansas City, Missouri. When did the city first put that in place?
Well, the ban the box, as I remember, sort of started maybe 5 or 6 years ago. There was this movement to either remove the criminal history question from the application process or at least move it back to the pre-offer stage. And I think the first city I can remember to do that was New Haven, Connecticut, where they removed that criminal history question or moved that later in the process, as I said, because a number of individuals were being simply denied the opportunity for jobs when the question was asked on the application, have you ever been convicted of a felony? In some cases, they also included misdemeanor. And we all know that when that box is checked yes, the application goes in the trash. And you're not considered, regardless of what your qualifications are, regardless of how long ago the conviction was, in some cases, whether or not you were even convicted. Because in some places, just the arrest or a charge led to that removal from the applicant pool. And so the city took it upon itself to remove that criminal history question and put it later in the application process. Now, background checks can still be done and are done. And this was something, again, that the city did for city employees. And it's been, I've heard, quite successful in that our applicant pools grow because more people are making it through that initial application stage. Individuals who do have records, again, pre-offer, are given the opportunity to explain the nature of the conviction, as I said before, and give details as to what they've done to rehabilitate themselves since conviction, whether they got some type of certification, degrees, other work experience, and the like, that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to discuss had you just marked the box and been and eliminated from consideration. As part of our training, when we go out and speak with employers and HR professionals and the like, I always tell people that there are some factors that you should consider when you talk to people about criminal histories. First, does the conviction have a reasonable relationship to the job? I mean, if you're a bus driver or you want to be a bus driver and you've been convicted of a DUI, well, that makes sense because driving is essential to that of a bus driver. But if you've been convicted of forgery, you can still drive a bus because and the relationship isn't the same. Secondly, the time elapsed since release from confinement. What have you done to rehabilitate yourself since you were no longer under the criminal justice system? Have you gone to school, certifications, licenses, other work experience? And I know in our research, we've shown that a person who's been released from confinement after 7 years is no more likely to reoffend than someone who's never offended before. So these blanket policies that keep people from ever getting jobs because of criminal histories don't really stand up when the evidence shows differently.
Thank you for that. That was beautifully stated. And I'm going to transition, Greta, to your housing area. I'm going to borrow from the General Council of HUD. They passed an ordinance in November of 15, and they gave guidance on it in April 16. And housing has added this same discouragement of a blanket exclusionary policy for people with criminal convictions. And the reason for that is because across the United States, blacks and Hispanics are arrested, convicted, and incarcerated at rates disproportionate to their share of the general population. Consequently, criminal records-based barriers to housing and employment are likely to have a disproportionate impact on minority home and job seekers. While having a criminal record is not a protected characteristic, underemployment or fair housing, criminal history-based restrictions on housing opportunities and job opportunities violate the Act if, without justification, their burden falls more often on persons of one race or national origin over another. So, Greta, I think I first heard of you with respect to this very recent April 27, 2017 Civil Rights Summit, the seventh annual summit that Kansas City Human Relations Department did.
Right, and we have our Civil Rights Summit every year, and actually it was our ninth, and these are subjects, like Paul has mentioned, that we cover in our ordinance and other things that we investigate.
So the HUD notice came out of a United States Supreme Court case, Texas Department of Housing versus Inclusive Communities. And the Supreme Court held discrimination can be found not only when the landlord means to treat one group with prejudice, but also when the landlord has a neutral policy that harms one group of persons more than others, what we call an adverse impact of a policy. That mirrors the guidance on employment, and it addresses public housing agencies. Greta, what is a public housing agency in Kansas City, Missouri?
Well, it may become more commonly known as a housing authority, and this is an entity. It's not part of the city, but is an entity that is receives public funding or HUD funding. But the difference in the guidance that you just read is not just covers public housing issues. It also covers private industry too. I think it was initially issued to cover public housing, but they have since expanded that to include private landlords too. And just like housing, and just like employment, as Paul was describing, these blanket policies did not cover or did not give people the opportunity once they were released from incarceration or conviction, parole or probation, give them an opportunity to get housing. And it was creating what we call high recidivism, I'm sorry, I couldn't spit that out, where people, like Paul was mentioning, they can't get housing, and can't get employment. It creates a cycle, and they end up back in the criminal justice system again. And I think that was the purpose of that guidance issued by HUD. Unlike EEOC, this HUD's guidance is pretty recent, and EEOC's guidance has been in place, Paul, what do you think, for like 20, 30 years?
I was in line at the grocery store and happened to run into a friend of mine who's a landlord and said, well, I'm going to do a presentation on this HUD guidance. And he got a little excited on the idea that it should be perfectly okay to rent to people with criminal conviction history. So can we say anything to make this appear? He saw it as a problematic that, and if I rent to people with criminal history, I'm renting to people that are bad tenants. So what's your experience on that? That's not true.
No, and just like Paul had mentioned before, that that idea is not supported by statistics. There's has been research and studies done that says that a person is no more likely to commit a crime or reoffend after 7 years than a person who had not ever been convicted of a crime. So these ideas or these thoughts are not supported by evidence that you're not necessarily writing to criminals just because you use they have criminal records. Just like Paul had mentioned also, you know, we don't expect for landlords to not do background checks or screening, but we expect for them to apply the same type of rules that Paul had mentioned. How long it has been since the conviction? Have they done anything to rehabilitate? And things of that nature. And that's all that we expect for them to do, to just give people the opportunity to apply for housing. They have to otherwise still be able to pay for their housing. They still are expected to follow the rules of the landlord's tenant policy. And so all of those things still apply. This is about the opportunity to obtain housing and not be shut out just because of a previous criminal conviction. And like he said again, it does disproportionately affect minorities. Blacks and Hispanics are disproportionately affected by these blanket rules. We had one case where there was actually on the application that you could not have committed a felony within the last 100 years. Well, that was totally impractical and not grounded in
senior center.
So that definitely is not grounded in any kind of evidence or research or studies that have been conducted.
It's the blanket exclusionary policies that are the problem, and that show the disproportionate impact on people. So it's fun to kick around this idea. If there's a blanket exclusionary policy, we don't rent to people with criminal convictions, that's going to affect both black people and white people. Mm-hmm. Unlike our regular intentional housing or employment discrimination, I'm not going to give a job to a person because of their race. I'm not going to give housing to a person because of their race. So I'm not going to give housing to anyone with a criminal conviction. That can discriminate against blacks, Hispanics, whites. Therefore, the question is that discrimination? But what we see is, given that blacks and Hispanics, minorities, are subject to conviction more frequently and stops, we've had programs on this subject before, then you have a larger number that are negatively affected by these blanket rules. And so what are some of the things you ask the landlords to consider?
Just like we had said before, we asked them to consider when it has been, how long it has been since the conviction, the tenant or prospective tenant has done anything to rehabilitate. They also ask them to check if they have reoffended since the conviction. So those are the type of things that we ask them to consider.
As opposed to just having a rule saying we won't rent.
Exactly.
Right?
Uh-huh. And when you have blanket rules like that, it will sometimes affect those protected categories. And Paul and I had a discussion earlier. It may disproportionately affect certain minorities, but the ex-offender issue itself can affect everyone, you know, because they aren't using the proper guidance, you know, they are using, you know, for screening.
That is so true. You do your time as punishment for your crime, and then in our system, you get out and continue to do your time in the real world. It's like there's no end to the time one has to do. And a person, in all fairness, can only improve, and if they have a nice place to live, if they have a house to support that. And so now then, let's talk about the evidence you guys like to see when people make complaints of either employment or housing. What type of evidence is helpful?
Employment case in employment situations, depending on the nature of the complaint, there are certain things that are relevant and some that aren't. For example, if someone feels that they're being discriminated against in terms of their attendance, obviously their attendance records and work schedules will be important, not so much a company's policy on short-term disability. So it always depends on the nature of the complaint as to what evidence is going to be required to verify or not verify the allegations in that complaint.
And the same will be for employment. If a failure to make repairs because I'm a woman, and you compare that to a male tenant, we will look at their tenant records and their maintenance records to see, okay, which tenants are you doing repairs for more often than the other. And we'll look at tenant lists, we'll look at maintenance records, and again, it just all depends on the nature of the complaint.
So I would say we all have very good jobs. Now then, this ordinances are under review in the Missouri legislature right now, the Missouri Senate Bill 43, now with the governor. That is going to create a more difficult causation standard for these cases, changing from what's currently allowed discrimination a contributing factor to it being required to be the motivating factor for a lawsuit. Individual liability for supervisors will be gone in Missouri, and punitive damages will be capped. It's very important for people to know if they want to make a complaint to bring your evidence. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Now, the calendar for May 22nd. State Representative Judy Morgan will be holding an end-of-session town hall meeting on Thursday, June 1st, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut Street, KCMO. Find out what bills passed, what bills didn't pass, and why. Change Yourself, Change Your World, Moore Square's annual Transformation Banquet will be held Thursday, June 8th at the Marriott Muehlbach, 1201 Wyandotte Street, KCMO. Social Hour starts at 5:30 p.m. with dinner at 6:30 p.m. Speakers will include Reverend B. Denise Welch, National Chair of Gamaliel Women Leadership Training, and Reverend Dr. John Welch, Chair of the Gamaliel Board of Directors. For information on tickets and price, contact Doug Schaefer at 816-210-8822 or by email at trustbuster@yahoo.com. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Mike Murphy, for sitting in for Beth Pike. Tune in next week on Memorial Day. We talk with the Veterans Community Project about their Tiny Homes Project, and Warrior's Best Friend about their work training service dogs for veterans. Coming up next is Melvin and his guest, Joshua Aiken of the Prison Policy Institute.
Good morning. Welcome to the next second half of Jaws of Justice. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt, and I will be talking to Mr. Joshua Aikens, and he is part of the Prison Policy Initiative. Is a non-profit, non-partisan organization that produces cutting-edge research to expose the broader harm of mass criminalization. Joshua Aikens is the policy fellow at the Prison Policy Initiative. He is the author of Report Reinstating Common Sense that called attention to nearly 200,000 driver's licenses suspended every year for drug offenses unrelated to driving. Joshua received his master's in U.S. history and forced migration studies at the University of Oxford, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar, and his undergraduate degree at Washington University in St. Louis. At this time, I'm going to welcome Mr. Joshua Aikens. Welcome this morning.
Hey, Melvin. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're with us. Mr. Joshua Aikens is on the phone in Washington. And so my first question is, tell us, our guests, a little bit about the prison initiatives.
Sure. So the Prison Policy Initiative is, as you said, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. And our research really focuses on showing how the criminal justice system harms our entire society. So with a system that has 2.2 million people in prisons and jails in our country, and hundreds of thousands of people churning through those facilities every year, our organization really tries to point out how that impacts not just people who are locked behind bars, but also their families and their communities, and how it has serious implications for the children of incarcerated people or the loved ones, and really showing that this is a system that has effects for all of us and really tries to steer policies and proposals in another direction, in other ways where we can rebuild communities and really address the harms of mass incarceration.
And what are some of those harms that affect not only the criminals, but the families as well?
Well, some of the research that we do shows the impact of when people are incarcerated, them being separated from their families. So we've done research on visitation policies, and a number of jails across the country are putting in place new policies where people are only able to interact using video teleconferencing. So using video visitation as opposed to being able to sit across from their loved one and actually be in the same room with them or actually see their face. And we found research that shows that when people are able to make eye contact with their loved one, that has a very serious impact on people's chances of getting out of prison and then staying out of prison as opposed to going back into the system. So when people are better able to connect with their families and able to really have a support network once they finish time behind bars, there are lots of things where if people are able to be better connected to their communities, stay in touch with their families, and be reintegrated into the communities that they were a part of, they're better able to stay out of the system. And so those are the types of things that we try to highlight in terms of how it affects who gets into the system and who is able to stay out. And then also the communities, where if you have dozens of people in your community or your neighborhood who are locked behind bars, that has an impact on everyone. It has an impact on the local school and the kids who are attending that school and how they do in their classes. All of those sorts of things really spiral from locking up people and locking up people en masse. And so really our work is trying to address how this impacts everyone across the board.
Not cutting you off, Joshua, that when you mentioned about the children being impacted, are you talking about the children that are connected to those that are incarcerated, or are you just talking from a broad statement that how it affects a community and how it affects families?
Well, on the first point, it's definitely about the children, the people who are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. You know, there are tons of fathers and mothers who are behind bars, and sure. When people are separated from their parents for years on end, there's research that shows that that has very serious implications for how they do in school and what type of support network they have when their parent is not there. And then in addition to that, you know, we find that in the same communities where people are routinely being locked up, there are school-to-prison pipelines that have police officers or security guards in schools that often can be steering people into the criminal justice system from middle school on. And so really it's a kind of a broad system that impacts people from all directions, but really has an impact on the families of those who are incarcerated, and really impacting, you know, kids from a young age who are separated from their mother or their father, and realizing that the system hurts those children too.
This is really necessary in the things that you're saying in terms of statistics. But I wanted to let our listening audience know that the substance of really of this broadcast is where we're going to be talking about the death that is related to those that are incarcerated. And so we're going to shed some light on that. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about how they utilize the laboring of prisoners.
Sure. So one of the things that we've pointed out in our research recently is that people who are behind bars, it's very rare that the labor that they're doing is creating products that are going out into what we call the free world. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an idea that people are behind bars and they're putting together products that you're going to find in your Walmart or your Target. And that's not really the case. But more what the case is that when people are locked behind bars, they're taken out of their communities. And so the communities where you have large numbers, especially of people of color, especially young black men who are behind bars, you have an entire group of people who would be, if they were in the free world, contributing to the economy, contributing to their communities, to their families, bringing income into those communities. They're locked behind bars, and they're either not working, not able to work, or they're more than likely doing labor that is just keeping the prison or the jail open. So they're cooking in the kitchen, or they're cleaning the facility. So really, when we talk about prison labor, I think one of the things that our recent research has really pointed towards is that people are making very small amounts of money, usually doing jobs for the prison facility to stay open, and so they're cooking and cleaning. And the bigger harm that's created is that people are being taken out of their communities and not able to contribute to their communities in the free world, as opposed to they're locked behind bars and usually just working to keep the prison or the jail functioning.
What would you say to someone that's listening and say, well, most of these people need to be locked up because most of them are incarcerated for drug dealing, but really some trivial type of drug dealing. So what would you say to our listening audience that maybe feel that way? And probably so, you know, rightly so. So, you know, address that a little bit.
One of the things that I often first point to when people kind of have that line of thought is looking at who's behind bars and asking why they're there and asking how can we help them get out and stay out? Because the overwhelming majority of people who end up in jail or prison are going to come back into the free world. And so what I'm always thinking about is how are we creating policies that not only help people get out and stay out, but what are we creating on the outside to make sure that people are never steered into the system in the first place? So you mentioned people who are in prison or jail for drug offenses or committed an offense while using drugs or under the influence. And one of the things that we find is that a huge number of people, especially in jail, have diagnosable substance abuse disorders. So there are many people who would be better treated by receiving substance abuse treatment than being locked in prison or jail. And so one of the things that our research really focuses on is trying to talk about alternatives to incarceration and making sure that when people are behind bars that they're getting the help that they actually need, and realizing that incarceration may not always be the best solution for people who really just need help finding a job, really just need help, you know, dealing with an addiction, really just need help with mental illness or mental disability. And so what our work really tries to do is lift up the voices of people who are incarcerated, show that they are going through, you know, the complexities of lives just like any of us, and tell their stories so we can actually provide them with the types of support networks that will help them re-enter society and really make sure that they stay out of the criminal justice system. Because I think one of the things that we forget is that people can get steered back in again and again and again. And what we really should be pushing for is helping people get out and stay out.
Yeah, and we know that with this new administration that they're now beginning to cut some of those necessary type programs that are set up with what you're talking about. So how can that ever happen when they're scaling back a lot of the social institutions that are doing things like that? What would you say about that? And have you experienced that? And do your agency track that?
I think we're definitely in the criminal justice world very wary of some of the ways that the support networks for people who are formerly incarcerated or just the rights of people who are behind bars could be rolled back, and especially as the new administration talks about reintroducing the harshest prosecution of a number of offenses, we have the worry, and I think a lot of organizations do, that the numbers of people in prison or jail are going to go back up. There's been, you know, a slight dip over the last couple of years, and those numbers could shoot right back up with some of these mandatory penalties, especially for drug offenses. And so one of the things that we're trying to really emphasize, and the research makes very clear, is that, for one, the you know, large number of people who are behind bars, research indicates, really don't necessarily need to be there or are going to get out at some point. And so talking about how those people really are where we need to be investing, providing resources, providing job training, supporting with the types of medical or mental health needs that they might have, that's really a better investment than just locking people away and tossing the key.
Skill
and I think that's
developing.
One of the things that we're really paying attention to with the new administration is, you know, we've been steering away from that for the last several years, and that's been a good thing. We've been moving towards reform, but that could all be rolled back very quickly if we're not careful.
Yeah, and they what I believe that they are having is some of the most stiffest penalties as it relate to menial crimes. And I noticed that you guys are doing some things like that with the Prison Initiative and researching some of those things. And what are some of the other things that you guys are doing, especially when you was talking, you and I was talking about the overrepresentation of some of the ones that are incarcerated, if I'm making any sense with that?
Sure. So we've done a fair amount of research breaking down the racial disparities that we see throughout our criminal justice system. So people of color are about 28% of the population, but the majority of people who are in jail, for example, are people of color. And so we really point to the vast overrepresentation of communities of color, of low-income communities, of the LGBT community, and really shed light on the people who are most impacted. Because one of the things that we're finding, and we're doing research right now on the jail system in the United States and looking at bail policy. And when bail's set, lots of people who end up staying behind bars end up there because they're too poor to make bail. Mm. And we've done research on this showing that it's people of color and it's low-income folks who are most impacted by bail policies. And the growth of local jails in recent years really has been a result of those trends. And so one of the things our research really tries to shed light on at the state level is that there are vast racial disparities in our system of incarceration in this country, and that certain communities are being hit hardest time and time again. And so, as I was saying earlier, we're looking at the broader harms this has on communities, on neighborhoods. And when, you know, a good number of the young black men in your community or a good number of the young people in your community are either in the criminal justice system or have a criminal record, it makes it that much harder for that community to, you know, have people have jobs, stable incomes, and really rebuild communities that have been impacted by our system of mass incarceration. So we try to point out those disparities and those overrepresentations of people of color in the criminal justice system.
Sure. We want to get we want to get into the meat of this topic, and that's we're going to talk about the deaths that occurs in custody of individuals. But before we get into that, I want to ask a quick question. With all of this imprisonment, how is that related to the 13th Amendment, if it does?
Well, one of the things, and I think the really great documentary that came out from Netflix and Ava DuVernay, 13th, pointed at this, is that many parts of our criminal justice system are legacies of American history. And I think the 13th Amendment is just one piece of a broader set of laws and policies that end up being remnants of a system of racial subordination that this country has a long history of. And so the 13th Amendment is one piece where we recognize that the system that we have today of locking people up, of imprisonment, was the exception in the 13th Amendment to other types of equality that were being put in place. And so the fact that large numbers of black people are behind bars and part of our criminal justice system, which again was the exception in the 13th Amendment to the types of forced labor that were allowed in this country, the 13th Amendment gives us an insight into the broader system of mass incarceration and helps us look at who's behind bars and why are they there. And I think one of the things that's important is that the 13th Amendment isn't the only thing that we should look to in terms of legacies of American history that impact our criminal justice system. There's a lot of places we can look. But I think the 13th Amendment does help us start to think about who's most impacted by this system and whether or not the system is really perpetuating inequalities that haven't been ingrained since the Reconstruction era. Sure. And so I think the 13th Amendment really points us in that direction and makes us look at the criminal justice system with a critical eye, and it should make all of us alarmed seeing the sheer number of black people and people of color who are churned through the criminal justice system and have been over the last several decades.
Sure. Let's dive into the deaths that are in custody by those that have committed crimes and, you know, just strangely have come up dead in cells. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So one of the things that I think is most alarming about our system right now is that we're seeing dozens of people end up dead behind bars. And while people behind bars are entitled to medical care, entitled to a number of rights to really make sure that, you know, being behind bars isn't in and of itself, you know, a punishment because people are receiving poor care or neglect, new research and new attention is being shed on the sheer number of people who are dying behind bars. And especially concerning is an increase in the number of people committing suicide while behind bars. And in 2014, the number was the rate was the highest it had been since 2000. And alarmingly, a lot of people who are committing suicide are doing so within the first week of being in jail. Mm. And so one of the things that criminal justice researchers are really trying to call attention to is, one, asking whether or not we're actually locking up people that we need to be locking up, because a lot of people end up behind bars, as I mentioned, because they're just too poor to make bail. And then two, do we have the right policies and procedures in place to make sure that people's mental health and medical needs are met right away? Because we shouldn't be seeing so many people dying or committing suicide behind bars, but that's really what the trend has been in the most recent years.
So what I'm kind of hearing is that possibly that some of those that have met death, for lack of a better word, being incarcerated is possibly because they wasn't getting their medication. And then you mentioned about that within the first 2 or 3 days they were found dead. Was anything suspicious that was going on around that death or those deaths? Have you found out?
I mean, I think there's definitely differences, and it's a case-by-case basis, mm-hmm. but what's been particularly concerning are the sheer number of cases where there's neglect from jail officers, or where there is, you know, no one checks in on the medical needs of someone for, you know, weeks on end before someone ends up dead, and exactly as you said, right, they were missing their medication, or some part of their mental health needs weren't being met. And one of the things that research shows is that being incarcerated can amplify a lot of the already types of mental health needs or mental illnesses that people are experiencing coming into incarceration. Incarceration can make that worse. And so what we're trying to call attention to is that jail and prison officials really have to be focused and honed in on making sure that they're meeting those needs, because people shouldn't be ending up dead behind bars. And that's something that we really are trying to call attention to as a troubling trend in terms of suicide, but then a number of other illnesses and diseases, trying to make sure that people are receiving the type of care that they deserve. Because as I said, we shouldn't be seeing the sheer number of people who are dying behind bars. And you know, there are cases of neglect, and in other cases, it's just trying to make sure that the policies and procedures are in place that make sure that things like this don't happen, and especially don't happen at the rate that they're happening right now.
Sure, real quickly, and we shed some light on a lot of things, and we only have a couple of more minutes left in the broadcast. Tell us a little bit about how did you get involved in this particular field?
So I got involved doing criminal justice work from my time at WashU in St. Louis, and I'm really indebted to a couple of professors that I had there who got me connected with a variety of things happening in the St. Louis community, whether it's activism, whether it's the St. Louis Juvenile Detention Center, whether it's prison performing arts, the number of organizations that are doing great work with people who are incarcerated, people who are formerly incarcerated, or people who are impacted by the criminal justice system really impacted me. And I think growing up, the criminal justice system has always been a part of my life. I think for lots of people like me growing up, if you're black in this country, odds are you know someone who's incarcerated or you know someone who has been incarcerated. And so for me, I would look at people in my family or friends of family and see people who were the exact same age as me who were getting caught up in the criminal justice system, and knowing that they should have been on the exact same path that I was on, which was going through school and really, you know, having a good public education and then going to a great university like WashU and wanting that for other people, and then seeing that
we're gonna have
one
to,
reason or another,
we're gonna have
people
to
get
yeah,
caught up.
We're gonna have to end that right there. And we were talking to Mr. Joshua Akins, and he is with Prison Policy Initiative, and it's a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization. Could you give your information real quick before we go off air?
Sure. So you can visit our website at prisonpolicy.org, and you can join our newsletter there, and we distribute information about our research and advocacy on that site. So definitely check the website out.
One more time.
Prisonpolicy.org.
Thank you, Mr. Joshua Akins. Have a great day.
420 Drug War News.
Hey, I'm Dr. Elias Jackson, Director of Scientific Public Relations at Verifarm Biopharmaceuticals. Verifarm is a biotech firm here in Houston at the Texas Medical Center. And we're a precision-based pharmaceutical biotech. And some of the studies that we look at are from two different points. One is testing of the efficacy of medicinal cannabinoids. And two is actually precision targeting of medical cannabinoids. So in the testing, making sure looking at the efficacy and precision targeting allows us to actually visualize or image where the particular cannabinoid is being used by the body. So now you can then treat a person depending on their genetics. So you can find out exactly which strain works for that individual. If there's a hereditary disease in a family, you can be able to see which strain actually is targeting the specific areas necessary to actually combat that disease. So now that family knows exactly what the dose that they need and actually which strain works better for them.
Doctor, what you're saying flies boldly, directly in the face of many of our legislatures, both state and federal, who say there is not enough science, not enough information to change our laws in regards to marijuana or medical cannabis, as it should more appropriately be described. Your thought in that regard, sir?
Oh, no. There's a lot of research out there that shows that cannabinoids actually inhibit the activity of a lot of elements that's involved in aging, that's involved in inflammation, that's involved in even cancer development. Obviously, we need a lot more research, though, to actually nail it down. However, I think the research is there enough to warrant more research and also open the door to whereas patients with other debilitating diseases can now start looking at different forms of treatment. In the case of cancer, chemotherapy has been out there for a while, and it has been our best method of aiding and treating these patients. However, if we can introduce a cannabinoid treatment, I'm sure we will find that those individuals will have a better quality of life. So once we start to show that even more so, I think that lawmakers and also individuals who believe in only one method or inside the box, they will start to open up and understand that this is actually the next level of patient treatment and also quality of life.
Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.